You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a message from CyberBit. Mastering cybersecurity is like mastering a sport. You build muscle memory through rigorous practice, then you train as a team to foster cohesion while operating under pressure. Like athletes, cybersecurity professionals thrive on hands-on simulation. But traditional courses, certifications, and open-source labs won't build you a winning team. You need CyberBit. CyberBit offers a hyper-realistic simulation environment for your SOC, IR, and C-suite to refine your skills, all using the market-leading SIEMs, EDRs, firewalls, and WAFs they use every day. CyberBit is offering CyberWire listeners a free live fire exercise. Sign up your team now at cyberbit.com/cyberwire.
The Petya ransomware pandemic is spread essentially everywhere. It's worse than WannaCry and shows how little many enterprises did to protect themselves even after WannaCry's shot across their bow. Tanium's Ryan Kazantsian joins us with the latest from their investigation. I'm Dave Bittner in Baltimore with your CyberWire summary for Wednesday, June 28, 2017. Today's news is dominated by what we'll call, for convenience sake, the Petya pandemic. It's going by different names, PetyaWrap, NotPetya, and GoldenEye, to take three alternatives, but it's the same disturbing product. The ransomware infestation began in Ukraine and has still hit that country most severely, but it's spread rapidly around the world, worming its way through Windows systems that haven't patched for the Eternal Blue exploit used last month by WannaCry. Joining us is Ryan Kazantsian, Chief Security Architect at Tanium.
So yesterday morning, June 27th, around 8 or 9 a.m. Eastern time, just as I was getting up, there was some initial chatter of this ransomware strain infecting a number of organizations, primarily in the Europe and Eastern Europe region. There were a couple of reported infections around Ukraine, and then we started to see some spread with organizations really throughout the world, even a handful in the United States reporting that they had been impacted by this. And it was initially thought to be a variant of the Petya ransomware, which is a malware family that had been seen earlier this year. It has since been thought to be a different, or at least slightly related, but not necessarily just a minor update to the original Petya malware. So a few people have taken to calling it Kinyetia and other little puns and variants on that name.
So as we're recording, it's Wednesday morning on the 28th. Where do we stand right now?
Today we have a much clearer understanding of how this ransomware operates, how people initially got infected, and how it propagates than yesterday. There was a bit of a fog of war yesterday as this first emerged. You have to imagine that organizations that were targeted by it were busy putting out fires. And in the meantime, a lot of security vendors and security researchers were trying to piece together information from publicly available sources to understand how this thing worked. And so there was initially some incorrect assumptions made. A few folks started looking at samples and VirusTotal, found some that were definitely this new malware. Found some that were not actually related, and so there were some indicators of compromise that didn't actually end up applying. What we now know today is that the malware initially was transferred to impacted organizations through a software update that was laden with the malware, and that software update was for a Ukrainian tax accounting software package from a company called MEDoc. And as part of that update, The organization was apparently hacked, and the updated software included the malware delivery mechanism. And that is, in fact, how the initial set of victims got the ransomware. The initial thought had been that this malware was transferred to victim organizations by means of a malicious Word document attached to emails. That actually turned out to be incorrect. A few researchers had mistakenly correlated an unrelated malware family sample to this campaign. But when you look at the initial method of entry, you can get a sense of how victim organizations have been targeted and chosen by the attacker. If you see something that's like a blast email campaign targeting thousands or tens of thousands of accounts, then you can kind of sense, get a sense of what the targeting is. In this case, when you pinpoint a very specific vendor like MEDOC that has a very specific customer base from a regionality and an industry perspective, that certainly changes the scope of the attack and might provide some clues as to the attacker's intent.
At this point, what do we know about propagation?
So once an organization is compromised, once there's a patient zero, the malware uses a few different methods to propagate within that organization's network. The first thing that it actually does is rather unique compared to WannaCry, in that this strain of malware actually recovers credentials from your infected system, specifically the Windows accounts that are either local to the box or have recently logged in and still have credentials cached in memory. And then it uses those credentials to attempt to authenticate to other Windows systems in the same network using Windows protocols that are just native to the operating system. And so it has a built-in renamed PSExec utility that it uses with those credentials that it recovers to try to connect to shares on remote hosts. And once it's connected to those, it uses a combination of WMI, which is a native Windows tool, to basically execute the payload that drops the malware onto that host. And so what you ended up seeing is, even if you were patched against the most recent vulnerabilities in Windows, if your Windows environment was set up such that you had common credentials that could be used to mount administrative shares from host to host, or if a highly privileged user was unfortunately patient zero, then that allowed the malware to propagate to a lot more shares. And so it really became a automated version of the types of lateral movement that targeted attackers will often apply when moving from host to host. And so that was the first method. The second method was similar to WannaCry in that it used the Eternal Blue SMBV1 exploit. And the only distinction between WannaCry and this attack campaign is that this did not focus on spreading outside of the corporate network by means of the SMBV1 attack. It was more of a sort of fallback mechanism for propagation to complement the method that used the credentials on the box.
And so is there any sense for how wide this may spread?
It's still difficult to tell if we're at the long tail of propagation or if there's going to be a point of, you know, the sort of hockey stick growth that you sometimes see with some of these campaigns. The fortunate thing is that because the initial entry vector is fairly targeted in that coming from that Ukrainian tax software, it is unlikely that a very large number of organizations had a patient zeros. And so the damage that was done will likely be largely contained to those initial victims. That being said, there's nothing stopping the attacker from repackaging the same malware to be carried over different attack vectors, like the, for example, an Office macro attack, as was initially speculated to be one of the means of transmittal. And so it would not surprise me to see follow-up campaigns or copycat campaigns that iterate on the same concept. The fact remains that between organizations that fail to patch in a timely manner and that have not locked down their Windows network to prevent these sorts of host-to-host lateral movement, lots of other attackers can learn lessons from what worked and what didn't work in previous campaigns and adapt their future campaigns accordingly.
And so how about prevention? How can people protect themselves against this?
It's interesting. I think, you know, everyone says that WannaCry caught the entire industry with our pants down insofar as almost no one was being as aggressive as they should have with patching. You had a 3-month-old patch for a 30-month-old protocol, SMBV1, that Microsoft has been telling people to disable for upwards of 3 or 4 years now. And yet still WannaCry rolls around and months later, no one's patched. There's a lot of reasons behind that. I don't mean to say that for victim shaming purposes. You know, patching in many organizations is tedious and complex, and a lot of the patch management and systems management solutions that companies use are using ancient technology. And so systems management and the discipline and focus around that ends up being really critical here. And the same is true for this most recent strain of malware, where, yes, it's true that even if you were patched, it could still propagate, but the principles around locking down lateral movement, protecting credentials on endpoints, restricting the types of host-to-host traffic that this malware took advantage of, have, again, been talked about for upwards of 5 years as principles to restrict any form of lateral movement, not just wormable attacks. And so these are, again, I look at these as failures of systems management, more so than simply matters of failing to detect a new strain of malware. The reality is there will always be new strains of malware that our prevention tools fail to detect. There will always be new attack vectors that a lot of security prevention tools have failed to consider.
Our thanks to Ryan Kazantzian from Tanium for taking the time out to join us this morning. As you might imagine, they've been busy.
Every day, your IAM tech debt grows. Your multi-generational services struggle to work together. Building an identity fabric can fix this. It makes all your identity tooling stronger and allows you to connect any app to any service you want to use with zero coding, zero maintenance, and zero app downtime. Strata's identity orchestration platform separates the identity logic from your applications so you can optimize existing IAM tools and manage them in a single control plane. Now, every vendor, standard, and architecture work together. In short, building your identity fabric means you can secure your non-standard apps, keep your complex access policies, retire outdated IDPs, and modernize in record time. So build your fabric with Strata Identity and get rid of tech debt for good. Visit strata.io/cyberwire, share your identity priorities, and receive a pair of AirPods Pro. Offer valid for organizations over 5,000 employees. Connect today at strata.io/cyberwire. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business. And I'm pleased to be joined once again by Ben Yellen. He's a senior law and policy analyst at the University of Maryland Center for Health and Homeland Security. Ben, welcome back. You know, you and I often talk about these cases that are making their way through, and we say to ourselves, this one may make its way to the Supreme Court. Well, today we're talking about one that did make its way to the Supreme Court, actually got a unanimous decision. Take us through what we've got here today.
It's rare to see unanimous decisions on things that we would think of as controversial, but that's exactly what we saw in this case called Packingham v. North Carolina. The state of North Carolina passed a statute that made it a felony for registered sex offenders to access social media websites like Facebook and Twitter if they might encounter minors on those websites. And the Supreme Court, in an 8-0 decision, the newest justice, Justice Gorsuch, did not take part in it, held that this law is unconstitutional, and that's not surprising. Justice Anthony Kennedy, who wrote the opinion, wrote, and I quote, "A fundamental principle of the First Amendment is that all persons have access to places where they can speak and listen, and then after reflection, speak and listen once more." Ever since the Supreme Court really started to explore First Amendment jurisprudence, particularly in the last 80 years or so, they've been extremely hesitant to allow what we call prior restraint. And that's restriction on a method of speech before the speaker has even uttered those words. It's one thing for law enforcement to punish somebody for the words that have been spoken, and there are a number of exceptions in First Amendment jurisprudence that allow punishment for somebody's words.
Well, we always think of, you know, shouting fire in a crowded movie theater. That's what everyone always says. You can't do that, right?
Yeah. So if your speech will create what we call imminent lawless action, and that's the legal standard, then that's not constitutionally protected speech. And those are the kind of restrictions that the Supreme Court has generally allowed over the years, where they've been extremely hesitant to restrict anybody, even the most objectionable people in society, people who have been convicted as sex offenders. They've been incredibly reluctant to limit any venues for speech. And it makes sense to us. This is the equivalent in the 1800s of preventing somebody from going into a public square and making a political statement. You can't prevent somebody from using a venue to speak their mind entirely. And I think it's completely unsurprising that the Supreme Court reached this decision unanimously. Whatever you think about the plaintiffs in this case, I think they're upholding a fundamental tenet of our First Amendment.
And interesting for us specifically, because this is one of the first cases that have made it to the Supreme Court that have to do with social media and these modern methods of communication.
Yeah, I mean, in effect, what this decision is saying is that people have a constitutional right to use social media. Again, social media has just become a venue to be used. It's the equivalent to any physical place or any other type of place. It's a place where people can speak political ideas, where there can be a marketplace of ideas, even for the most objectionable views. The Supreme Court is acknowledging that even though these are private entities, you can't ban a person from using this critical venue. This is just the way we get our ideas out in the 21st century. And I think the Supreme Court is recognizing that principle. And from now on, there is a precedent that a person has a constitutional right to use social media to express themselves. And I think that's going to be a very important precedent going forward.
All right. Ben Yellen, thanks for joining us.
Are lengthy security reviews pulling attention away from your security program? With the largest network of trust centers, Vanta can help you streamline security reviews to win customer trust, save time, and close deals fast. Proactively demonstrate security by showcasing key resources like your SOC 2 or ISO 27001, and provide real-time evidence for passing controls. And when a security questionnaire is required, Vanta takes the first pass for you. Visit vanta.com/cyber to take a self-serve tour. That's vanta.com/cyber.
And that's the CyberWire. We are proudly produced in Maryland by our talented team of editors and producers. I'm Dave Bittner. Thanks for listening.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.